Welcome back. I'm Peter St. Ange. This is a weekly roundup of my daily videos on the economy and freedom, where I cut through the BS and lay out what the gaslighting clowns pulled out of their hats this week and what is coming next. It's official. Japan is in stagflation, somewhere it has not been since the 1970s. And America's not far behind. Really, our best hope is change the definition of stagflation like we did with recession. The nation of Japan is currently frozen in the headlights, stuck between a weak economy on life support from cheap money, super low interest rates, and a crashing yen as a result of those super low rates. The yen threatens the Japanese financial system, and it threatens savage price hikes for Japanese families who overwhelmingly depend on imported food and energy. In short, Bank of Japan needs to hike interest rates to save the yen and head off inflation, but they can't hike because of economic weakness. In fact, Japan just entered recession a few weeks ago. Now, the Bank of Japan had been trying to carefully maneuver between the two, so a little stimulus here, a little jawboning there, so the public does not notice what's happening. Well, last week, Japan's unions scrambled the chessboard, meaning inflation is coming and it could be here to stay. So Japanese unions typically coordinate pay negotiations every year. It's called the Spring Offensive, an intentionally military metaphor. Japanese unions used to be surprisingly violent. This year's offensive was a hand grenade. After literally 30 years of stagnant wages, this year Japan's large companies granted 4% annual pay hikes. Small and medium companies, which represent millions of workers, went all the way to 6%. And some large companies, it went much further. So Toyota, which is a bellwether for corporate Japan, granted every last yen the union asked for. Honda and All Nippon Airlines both granted almost 6%. Mitsubishi Heavy gave 8%. Nippon Steel, which is in the news for buying U.S. steel, forked over 12%, the biggest jump since 1979. Retailer Aeon granted 7% to its 400,000 part-time employees, signaling the wage hikes are trickling down to just about everybody, which is the Bank of Japan's worst nightmare. Now, all central bankers know that once inflation gets baked into union negotiations, it can be very, very hard to uproot. So, in short, Japan is already in recession. It's got 50% price hikes coming like a golf ball in a snake thanks to the weak yen, and now corporate Japan just baked it in. So what's next? The government of Japan is good at many things: crime, immigration, fixing potholes. What it's not good at is managing the economy. In fact, they've turned in 30 years of stagnation, bought with an eye-watering mountain of debt. So in U.S. terms, Japan's government debt is roughly $60 trillion. This raises the odds that a stagflationary Japan could be the spark that sets off a global financial crisis we haven't seen since 2008. More concerning, the dominoes are now falling towards a coordinated global stagflation in Europe, America, and even China, and now Japan. Last time this happened was in the 1970s, it only ended when Paul Volcker's Fed hiked rates high enough to engineer a pair of savage recessions, at the time the worst since the Depression. So we could be looking at a 2008 crisis and a 1970s stagflation altogether, which is something we have not seen since 1929. So what could stop it? Easy: slash government spending. That reins in inflation, it grows the economy by returning resources, workers, steel, capital, to the private sector. Of course, the opposite is happening. Biden just asked for another 20%. Eurozone governments now spend precisely 49.6% of their entire economy. And Japan is mulling a fresh spending package to fight inflation with handouts, so creating inflation to fight inflation. At this pace, we are headed straight for the 70s, just as fast as our governments can spend us there. If you are one of the millions of Americans who cannot buy a house, you are not alone. According to the Wall Street Journal, the American housing market is fading further and further out of reach for the middle class and, above all, for the young. The past 3 years have been brutal for housing costs, driven by four factors: soaring house prices thanks to the Fed, soaring mortgage rates thanks to the Fed, soaring home insurance thanks to Congress, and just last week, a massive settlement by the National Association of Realtors that could slash commissions but could saddle buyers with even more costs. So how did we get here? The story begins with the Fed printing $6 trillion to bribe voters into lockdowns that sent inflation soaring, which took house prices along for the ride. Then to fight its own inflation, the Fed jacked up interest rates, sending mortgage rates from 3% to 7% today. Put them together and the average payment on a new mortgage doubled to nearly $3,000, which is almost half the median household income just for the mortgage. In fact, one study found that just 16% of houses are affordable to the median American family. The rest are priced out. Predictably, the housing market seized up, with new home sales dropping by nearly half. At that point, Congress piled on with home insurance. I covered this recently, but government mismanagement of fires and floods have left nearly half of American homes exposed to catastrophic insurance risks. Combined with lawsuit-friendly policies, these sent insurance prices up 40% or more. So in Florida, the average policy now costs nearly $8,000 per year. Insurers are quitting California altogether, and tens of millions of Americans are going without home insurance, going naked in the industry lingo and hoping for the best. And finally, the realtors. Last week, the National Association of Realtors settled a bunch of lawsuits claiming they had fixed commissions. One industry analyst thinks this will slash commissions by a third, and it will slash the number of realtors by up to 80%. So if a former realtor is making your pumpkin frappuccino, be kind. Note, the average home sold in the U.S. last year paid 5.5% commission. In Canada, it's just 3%. The U.K. is at 2.6%, Holland runs 2%, and Sweden is at just 1.5%. Now, as a result of these lofty commissions, of course, America has an astounding number of realtors. The NAR claims 1.5 million dues-paying members. For perspective, that's about twice the number of farmers in America. So if commissions were to fall to, say, Canadian levels, you'd save about $12,500 in fees. If they fell to Swedish levels, you'd save closer to 20 grand. So far, so good, but the problem is currently commissions are paid by sellers. After the settlement, buyers may have to pay. So if you're buying a home, you'd have to pay the agent before they lift a finger, maybe an hourly rate or a lump sum contract. This could mean all those thousands end up going to house sellers, leaving buyers to pony up even more cash. So what's next? Housing in America has gone from a financial bedrock to a casino, where Americans are divided into life-changing winners and losers according to where they bought in the Fed's boom-bust cycle. Between prices, mortgage rates, and the insurance and commissions piling on, anybody who missed the Fed's great COVID giveaway could be stuck renting for life. A recent study found that fully two-thirds of American renters have given up on ever owning a house, while another study found that Gen Z is, quote, the most pessimistic generation ever. Unless the Fed gets out of the casino business, it only gets worse. I'm a big fan of saving Bitcoin for the long term, and the Unchained Bitcoin IRA is a great way to do that. You get the tax advantages, and if it's a Roth IRA, you're not going to pay capital gains so long as you HODL. Most Bitcoin IRAs make you give up control, which can expose you to exchange hacks or even re-lend it out like banks do. With Unchained, you control the keys to your Bitcoin, which means you always know it's there. They also provide one-on-one concierge service to walk you through it and answer any questions. Why pay more taxes than you need to? Set it up today at Unchained.com. Use promo code Peter to get $100 off a Bitcoin IRA. Congress wants more inflation. If they get their way, it could mean a permanent shift to higher inflation forever. A couple weeks ago, Jerome Powell was hauled into Congress to explain why the Fed, which is supposed to fight inflation, instead manufactures inflation for a living. Just kidding. This is Congress. In fact, Jerome Powell was hauled in to explain why the Fed doesn't crank up inflation even more. Or as the gathered Congress things put it, raise the inflation target from 2%, where it's been for decades, up to 3% and beyond, where it can fleece Americans gooder and harder. The background here is that the Fed has effectively maintained a 2% inflation target for roughly 30 years. Progressives high on MMT want a higher target so they can flood easy money to tissue fire the economy and bankrupt the country. Now, if you still believe in Santa Claus or central banking, it might come as a shock that there's literally no science behind the 2% target. Apparently, some random New Zealand banker made an off-the-cuff remark in 1988, and it spread like wildfire among the easily influenced cartel banker or central bankers of the world. Now, if I had to guess, the true reason for 2% is because central bankers think that's the highest number the public will accept. It's the highest number that mentally feels like you can ignore it. Bump that to 3, and the livestock get bullshy and vote for populists. And that brings us to Powell in Congress. In a recent exchange, Ohio progressive Sherrod Brown pressured Jerome why he doesn't cut rates right now to, quote, prevent workers from losing their jobs. Or as squatty Ayanna Pressley put it, quote, interest rates are too damn high. Powell responded that cutting rates could hike inflation, and he emphasized that the 2% target isn't going anywhere. In fact, he emphasized it 7 different times in the span of 5 minutes, which you only do when you're talking to stupid people. Of course, inflation is nowhere near 2% and hasn't been for years. By the friendliest measure CNN can dig up, it's 3.2 year on year, and on an annualized basis, it's closer to 5.5. But the Fed is on record. In fact, 7 times per 5 minutes, that 2% is the holy grail. The exchange illustrates what should be one of the scariest things in Washington right now, the fact that Jerome Powell is actually the hard money guy in D.C. He's under constant pressure to hike his target to 3, 4, and beyond. I had a series of videos last year tracing out what happens if the Fed does hike its target, but in short, would massively intensify the boom-bust cycle, so bigger tissue fires, bigger collapses, while obviously eroding your dollar that much faster and, for better or worse, accelerating the great paper money Ragnarok that history says is coming. So what's next? The Fed manufactured the biggest monetary crisis in 40 years, from inflationary boom to recessionary bust, papered over by deficits. It's now facing the political fallout from MMT Congress things whose constituents can see the jobs picture, even if government statisticians cannot. As for what comes next, if the guy who just engineered the worst inflation in 40 years is literally the hard money guy in D.C., we are in trouble. Powell's term is up in 26. Trump has already said he won't reappoint since Powell is, quote, political. On the other hand, a second-term Biden may well give in and replace Powell with a proper inflationist, of which there are many waiting in the wings. That happens, we could get a money printer that makes $6 trillion Powell look like a pipsqueak. The European Union wants to send Ukraine $300 billion seized from Russia's central bank. This could fatally undermine confidence in Western financial markets, and it could accelerate the decline of the dollar and even the euro. So a couple weeks ago, Janet Yellen gave a speech urging world leaders to send $300 billion in frozen Russian central bank assets to Ukraine so they can continue their war. The European Commission is set to do just that. Now, when Russia invaded Ukraine 2 years ago, the U.S. and its European allies seized $300 billion owned by Russia's central bank. That's equivalent to about $4 trillion, adjusting for the size of the Russian economy. They did this in hopes of setting off a bank collapse in Russia, perhaps one that ends with Putin hanging on a lamppost. Ironically enough, it was our banks that collapsed instead, starting with Silicon Valley, then Signature, Silvergate, and a bevy of regionals on life support before Washington stepped in with trillions in pre-bailout. The Russian assets were overwhelmingly dollar and euro denominated, and about 2/3 were physically located in the EU, primarily in a Belgium-based deposit holder called Euroclear. Now, the EU wants to take those frozen assets and start handing them to Ukraine to buy weapons from, say, Europeans. They're starting with the profits, about $3 billion per year, but some EU members want to hand over the entire $300, and sending the profits would be a big step towards that. The background here is that the EU's latest Ukraine weapons package was blocked by Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who opposes the war. Meanwhile, another $60 billion from Washington is being blocked by Republicans who are demanding that we fix our border crisis first. So, denied by their own democratic institutions, Biden and his Euro minions are doing it anyway. The problem here is that seizing the assets could fatally undermine global confidence in Western markets, because it would mean the US and Europe are very dangerous places to park your money if there's any chance the West could get upset at you. That especially matters to countries who make up a huge share of international assets. So how certain can Egypt, South Africa, or Indonesia be that Washington and Brussels will never, ever turn on them? The Biden administration has already threatened sanctions on Uganda over LGBT policy, and if sanctions reach all the way to seizing everything your country owns, no country would be dumb enough to play ball. In fact, just a few months ago, the Indonesian president gave a speech saying that very thing, that they must diversify from the dollar because, quote, look what happened to Russia. So what's next? De-dollarization has been a decades-long trend as our dysfunctional government cripples growth that has lagged the rest of the world. And it is now accelerating. So Rockstar analyst Stephen Jen estimates the dollar share of official currency reserves went from 73% in 2001 to 55% in 2021, and then it dropped off a cliff, hitting just 47% last year. That's 8% lost in 2 years, as Jen calls it, quote, a stunning collapse. Already, exporters around the world are switching from the dollar to other currencies, so Gulf nations are selling natural gas in Chinese yuan, and projections are for China's share of trade to triple in the next 10 years. Others, including central banks, are pawning their dollars for gold and real assets. The dollar is currently held up only by 15 rate hikes from the Fed and global turmoil that's fueling a temporary flight to safety. If Biden's European minions ram through this seizure, and if Janet Yellen goes along as she's already said she would, it could fatally wound both the dollar and its junior partner, the euro. So if you own gold or Bitcoin, that's great news, and it is terrible news if you own anything else denominated in dollars and euro. This podcast is supported by our sponsor, MoneyMetals.com, the most trusted bullion dealer and depository in the United States. Known for their competitive pricing, excellent customer service, and fast delivery of physical gold and silver, as well as their educational content and advocacy for sound money policies at the state and federal level. They have set the industry standard for selling, buying, and storing precious metals. If you're looking to help protect yourself against inflation and market turmoil, I hope you'll give them a try. To learn more or to buy your physical gold and silver, go to MoneyMetals.com. In case you've still got money in the bank, Bloomberg is warning that defaults in commercial real estate loans could, quote, topple hundreds of U.S. banks, leaving taxpayers on the hook for potentially trillions in losses. The note by senior editor James Crombie walks us through the festering hellscape that is commercial real estate. To set the mood, a new study predicts nearly half of downtown Pittsburgh office space could be vacant in 4 years. Major cities like San Francisco are already sporting zombie apocalypse downtowns with abandoned buildings baking in the sun. So what happened? In short, the Fed's yo-yo interest rates first flooded real estate with low rates and cheap money, which overbuilt. Then when the Fed panic-hiked interest rates in the 2021 inflation, that put trillions of commercial real estate underwater. This could mimic last year's bank crisis, where falling bond prices panicked depositors. They started pulling their money out of banks. That crisis only stopped when Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell effectively bailed out every bank in America with sweetheart loans written on fictitious asset values, along with unlimited taxpayer guarantees through the comically underfunded FDIC. By the way, the FDIC is essentially guaranteeing over $20 trillion in deposits at the moment on just over $100 billion. So they've got a half penny on the dollar. Now, without those government pre-bailouts, one paper last year by researchers at Stanford and Columbia estimated that 1,619 U.S. banks, it's about a third of them, could be at risk of failure. The problem is nothing was actually fixed. In fact, it's getting worse for the simple reason that as the months roll by, there's more and more debt coming due. And that brings us to Crombie, who notes that there's $929 billion of commercial real estate debt coming due in the next 9.5 months. That's up 28% from last year. And it's getting bigger every day as banks pretend that loans are still healthy by effectively adding missed payments back onto the loan. We're starting to see glitches in the matrix already. So New York Community Bank just went through a near-death experience over its garbage portfolio of real estate loans, dropping almost 80% before it was bailed out by vulture investors while the mega banks hovered like mega vultures. More will come, potentially a lot more. A new study from the National Bureau of Economic Research estimates that up to 385 American banks could fail over commercial real estate alone. These would overwhelmingly be small regional banks who typically hold about a third of their assets in commercial real estate loans. They hold so much because they know their local markets best, but the Fed poisoned that chalice by flooding easy money to developers. So what's next? For now, we're only seeing the sickest banks dropping out of the herd. That could dramatically accelerate as that trillion-plus in loans comes due. Commercial real estate delinquency rates have already jumped to 6.5%. That's up 30% in a couple of months. Rates of distress in office loans hit 11%. When the smoke clears, we could see dozens or hundreds of regional banks go under. Going by the last time that happened with savings and loans, taxpayers ended up eating 80% of the losses, meaning you could be on the hook for trillions while the mega banks gorge on the tasty carcasses. Slashing interest rates could staunch the bleeding, but with inflation marching up every month, currently at 5.5% annualized, that is not going to happen. Thanks for listening. Remember to subscribe to get next week's episode fresh in your inbox, and go to petersaintange.com to read the weekly articles with charts and all the gory details. Okay, we'll be watching. See you next time.